A Detroit police officer testifies under oath.
Was in 1953 when the 13th Precinct Cruiser Crew brought in a Negro prisoner who was handcuffed with his hands behind him. Four white members of the Cruiser Crew were mauling the prisoner and kicking him toward the desk where the lieutenant was to hear the facts of the case. As the prisoner was pleading with the officers to stop beating him, one of the officers took his blackjack and repeatedly hit the prisoner on the head until blood was spattered on the lieutenant's white shirt, and he was sitting behind the desk. And on my shirt, I was just giving the lieutenant a report. And the lieutenant told the arresting officers to lock him up before he ruins my shirt. Now, so much for police brutality. As a police officer, I've seen it. I know it exists. So therefore, I don't think that there's a problem as far as knowing that the Detroit Police Department does use brutality against Negroes.
On December 14th and 15th, 1960, the United States Civil Rights Commission held hearings in Detroit, Michigan, to determine the extent of racial discrimination in the areas of administration of justice, housing, employment, education, and voting rights. In this next half hour, we'll discuss the testimony and its implications for Michigan and the nation with the chairman of the Civil Rights Commission, Dr. John A. Hanna.
WKAR Radio at Michigan State University presents Special Report, The Detroit Hearings. And now here is WKAR's Director of News and Special Events, Rob Downey.
Since December of 1957, the chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights has been Dr. John A. Hanna, president of Michigan State University and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower in the administration of President Eisenhower. Dr. Hanna has presided over voting rights hearings in Montgomery, Alabama, and New Orleans, Louisiana, housing discrimination hearings in New York, Chicago, and Atlanta, hearings in the area of discrimination in education in Nashville and Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and general hearings in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Under his direction, the commission staff has conducted investigations and studies in many other areas. He's uniquely qualified by virtue of his position and academic background to observe and comment on the complex issues and problems of civil rights in the United States. Well, Dr. Hanna, we're concerned primarily in this program with the hearings conducted in your own Michigan city of Detroit. Why did you select Detroit, and what did you hope to discover there?
Well, Mr. Downey, first of all, thank you very much for your generous introduction. The commission is using the device of holding these hearings with witnesses, many of them volunteers, some of them subpoenaed before us, for the purpose of ascertaining what the facts are. As you know, our commission is charged by the legislation that created it with the responsibility of finding out if it is a fact that Negroes or other groups are being denied their civil rights. Now, the law that creates this gives us a specific responsibility in the area of voting and making certain that citizens are not being denied the right to register or to vote or to have their vote counted because of their color, race, religion, or national origin. In the early days of the commission, we decided arbitrarily to go into four additional areas and to investigate and find out what the facts are with reference to these often repeated allegations of discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing, discrimination in education that is much in the news in the South and throughout the country, throughout the world, and discrimination in the area of administration of justice. And then we have had some inquiries looking into discriminations against Indians, American Indians, and other minority groups. Now, as you indicated in my introduction, we have conducted hearings on specific phases of discrimination in many parts of the country, and then have held an across-the-board hearing in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco, and recently in Detroit. And I should say that the hearing in Detroit was not because the commission felt the situation in Detroit was very different than in any other large northern city, but we are anxious to find out what the facts are in a typical northern city with a large industrial employment, with a substantial fraction of all the citizens, Negroes. And that was the reason for the Detroit hearing.
Now, to find out what you actually learned in Detroit, let's start with the area we hinted at the beginning of the program, this matter of police brutality. Did you find that brutality existed in the Detroit Police Department?
Well, we found that it is alleged to exist. We had testimony from some former members of the Detroit Police Force that testified under oath that they did, of their own knowledge, know of specific instances where Negroes had been treated violently. And one of them, you'll recall, testified that twice while he was on the police force, but in civilian clothes, that he was set upon by fellow police officers and treated in a rather violent manner. And then, of course, when they learned that he was in fact a police officer, the situation was somewhat, he was given somewhat different treatment from that point on in one case, and in the other case he was not. Now, in fairness, it must be said that the commissioner of police in Detroit, Mr. Hart, I thought answered pretty well some of these allegations and indicated that he recognized that there was probably some validity to some of these charges, but that he and the city officials in Detroit were anxious to do everything that they could to alleviate the situation. Then I should say that the other principal classification of testimony in this area was the often repeated testimony that the police department of Detroit, and like the police departments in many other cities, the allegation was that they do not employ Negroes that would like to be employed that are fully as well qualified as whites are. And that when the Negroes are employed, they are pretty generally hired only in the lower categories, and that few, if any, of them become bureau chiefs or exercise positions of responsibility. Mr. Hart did attempt to answer this one and indicated that that they were anxious to have good police officers. And of course, I'm trying always to be fair, because our commission is interested in finding out what the truth is and listening to testimony on both sides. And Mr. Hart indicated, which is probably true, that there a smaller percentage of the Negroes that apply for positions in the police force are well qualified. And of course, as you'd recognize, and I do, this is generally true to the fact that, many of these Negroes have not had comparable educational opportunities to the whites, and many of them are not led to aspire to positions on police forces or in other segments of society. Well, that's a rather long answer, but these witnesses under oath satisfied me that undoubtedly there have been cases in Detroit, as there have been in many other American cities, where the Negroes have been treated less well than whites expect to be treated. But you haven't asked the question, but I would like to put in another point here, and that is that probably the same allegation could be made to low income, from the point of view of low income whites. I'm not a specialist in this area, but I have concluded as the result of these studies that in general the members of the disadvantaged economic groups are not given the same treatment when they are suspected of crimes as people are in more advantaged groups, whether they be white or black. And most of the blacks, of course, come at this bottom group, and this is a part of the response, or one of the reasons for this discrimination. Now, you might expand this, but perhaps you don't want to spend any more time on that question.
Just one more point. There was some criticism, too, wasn't there, of the power the police department has to investigate charges of brutality, that is, the investigation to be conducted within the department?
Yes, and I think this was a good point. A point was made that when the commissioner indicated that they investigated all the complaints that were made for brutality against Negroes, that they made an honest effort to investigate these alleged cases, and then they took appropriate disciplinary action. But the point was appropriately made that when the investigation is carried on by the people that are accused, it's likely to be less than objective, and I think that's a valid criticism.
What did you find in the area of housing?
Well, we found the situation in Detroit was about what I'd expected to find. First of all, unlike some northern cities, there are a considerable number of Detroit Negroes that are living in good homes, middle-class homes, and some luxury homes. It's also true, however, that in general, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for a Negro family to buy a lot in a new area and build their own home. And There may be good used houses that are available to them in areas where Negroes now live and where there is little resistance to their moving in. But the Negroes appropriately object to the fact that that they are denied the opportunity to build a house to suit themselves and that they're required to use second or third or fourth hand houses. Now, I think that it was clearly shown in this hearing in Detroit that there are many Negroes there living in middle class houses and in very high class houses. The public housing situation is about what you find elsewhere. That in general, the big city clears out the slums and builds a public housing project. In too many cases, they're high-rise apartments without adequate provision in the community for recreational facilities or playgrounds for the youngsters. And the result is, while these are open to all types of people, because of the fact that they are close together and not adequate recreational facilities or playgrounds, they tend to become wholly occupied by Negroes or members of other minority groups. There was also the usual complaint made that, the federal housing there was no discrimination or little discrimination practiced in Detroit, little of any, but that was not true of some of the federally assisted housing where the mortgages are guaranteed by the FHA or the Veterans Administration. These allegations we find in all the cities. So to answer your question in a nutshell, I would say the situation in Detroit as far as housing is concerned is about what you'd expect in a city of 1.75 million people, 400,000 Negroes. About 27% of all the people in the city of Detroit are now Negroes, and the situation is not as good as in some other places in the country and much better than in many other places in the country.
Now, you also investigated employment rights, the rights of individuals.
We're always interested in investigating these charges that are made over and over again, that Negroes are not given the same opportunity for a job that whites are, with it possessing the same capability. And of course, we start always talking about people with comparable qualifications, whether they're whites, blacks, Jews, or whatever they are. It means nothing if you say that there are X percentage of Negroes in the community and a much smaller percentage have jobs of a certain quality, because it may well be, as it usually is, that they've had little education and they aren't qualified in the same percentage that other groups are. Now, we were interested in looking at the situation in Detroit, first of all, for the reason that Michigan has a pretty effective FEPC law that's been in effect for some years, and we wanted to find out if this had bettered the situation as compared to what we found in some other places where they do not have a state FEPC law that they're trying to enforce.
Could I interrupt you just a moment? Will
yes.
You explain FEPC?
Fair Employment Practices.
Thank you.
The other thing we were interested in was the allegation has often been made that in the automotive industry and in the chemical industries, the Negroes are not treated as well as in other segments of the industrial economy in Michigan. And so we were interested in finding this out if we could. Now, you'll recall that the chemical industry in the Detroit area is pretty well located in Wyandotte and those suburbs in that area. And there are few, if any, Negroes living in those areas. And so the contention is made that it's just accidental, that there are few white people or few Negroes in the community, and that's partly responsible for the situation. Oh, I think there isn't any question that up until recently, Negroes were not encouraged to apply for employment in the chemical industry. You heard Mr. Ruther say that the automotive concerns, the big three, treated Negroes pretty well on the production lines, but they had few, if any, Negroes in supervisory or managerial positions. This was not refuted because the commission invited the three big automotive industries to appear before us and give us the other side of the picture. There is another side, but they didn't accept her invitation. So we have only Mr. Ruther's testimony and the testimony of others that were critical and had no testimony on the other side.
Did you receive testimony of discrimination within unions?
Well, yes, there was some testimony that some of the unions do discriminate, and generally these criticisms are leveled at the building trades. The same allegations were made in Detroit and elsewhere. Of course, the situation in Michigan is vastly better than in many sections of the country. In many sections of the country, the labor unions do discriminate against Negroes, but I think that's not generally true in the North and not generally true in the CIO.
What did you find in the area of public education?
Almost nothing in Detroit. As you know, there is no discrimination in education in Michigan, no intentional discrimination. There is some de facto segregation because of the fact that the Negroes tend to live in concentrated areas, and there are many school districts where all the families are Negroes, and therefore all the children in the schools are Negroes. There's some feeling on the part of some people that Negro teachers are not given the same opportunity as whites to get employment or are not assigned as well in the school system. But I thought this was pretty well answered by Mr. Brownell, the superintendent of schools down there. He indicated they're working at it. So I would say in general, that is, in most of the North, discrimination in education is really not a valid problem, nor is the discrimination in voting. This was on the agenda too, but as you know, in Michigan, we do not even have a literacy law in this state, and practically everyone is registered and permitted and encouraged to vote, so that this was not a matter of inquiry in Detroit.
You've said pretty much throughout the interview, Dr. Hanna, that the things you found were above what you might expect. I take it to mean that Detroit has no unique problems, or at least not many unique problems then.
I think that's a fair answer.
This would be a common problem for all northern cities then, the pattern which you've outlined.
I think that's
here.
True, and of course, as you know, I said after the Detroit hearing, in which I believe, that I think the most, the areas where the elimination of discrimination are most difficult to solve are those of our big northern cities. In the South, there is a problem of voting, which most assuredly soon is going to have to be settled, for in 1960, there's no justification for not permitting able, competent people to vote. And even the most ardent segregationists in the South are willing to admit that progress is going to have to be made in that area. The school segregation or desegregation moves very slowly in the South, but eventually it will be corrected. The difficult problem is the elimination of discrimination, particularly in housing in our big northern cities, where there's a tendency for the people in the cities to rush out to the suburbs and just let this problem settle itself.
You mentioned, and the other commission members mentioned frequently during the hearing, a vicious circle as a pattern for this problem in northern cities. Would you explain that?
Well, of course, what they were referring to was the fact that, in general, the Negroes are congested in the oldest section of the town, crowded together several times as densely as white people are, generally with very poor provisions for recreation or playgrounds for the children. Because of the old sections of the cities, the schools are inclined to be old schools, and the inclination is for the schools to be manned by the less good teachers. The people, the Negroes themselves, just because there has been little incentive for them to aspire to better positions in society, they have worked as servants and in the lowest paid areas. Little encouragement given to the young Negro that is bright to get himself educated so that he may look to a better position in society. So that you have the situation of the poor neighborhood, poor schools, juvenile delinquency and crime, and little incentive for these people to get out of the community or out of this social strata into which they're born and raised. And it becomes a matter of which comes first, the hen or the egg. And of course, this is aggravated by the fact that a very substantial number of these Negroes in northern cities have recently moved up from the South, where they have lived under very poor conditions and have had very little education. The northern Negroes that have been up here two or three generations, many of them have begun to move up the social ladder. And of course, they rather resent the in-migration of the Negroes from the South, because the poor behavior of these in-migrants results in criticism of the whole Negro race as a group and sets them back. Well, this is the circle you're talking about.
Is there any weak link or weak area in this circle that could be broken and break the entire
thing? Oh, I don't know. The real problem is to break it somewhere. And of course, I feel very strongly about this one. I came on the Civil Rights Commission 3 years ago not knowing very much about it, except recognizing, as most people in the North do, that this is a serious problem, knowing that Negroes were not permitted to go to the same schools as whites in the South, not permitted to vote, and Occasionally we have a race riot in the north, or have had some unfortunate ones in the past, and there are incidents in the press where a Negro family, first one, moves into a white area and there's a lot of commotion. Well, I recognize this was all bad. But having spent a good deal of time now for more than 3 years, I am convinced that this is the most serious domestic problem that faces America. And I say that from two points of view. First, it's important that this problem be solved from the point of view of maintaining tranquility in the United States. And I think we should be eternally grateful to Negroes as a group for their patience, for their willingness to undergo these continuing discriminations and to maintain patience and be willing to move as slowly, generally, as they have been satisfied to move. But more particularly, I feel that this is our most important problem because of the effect that it has on our role in the world. And as you know, this university has a great many operations scattered all around the world, more than any other university, 10 of these programs, most of them in non-white areas. And you mentioned in my introduction that at one time I served for a year and a half in the Defense Department, Assistant Secretary of Defense. And we spend in this country some $45 billion in maintaining a defense posture. But as I am as certain as I am that I'm talking to you, that we are never going to win the struggle with the Soviet communists on the battlefield. We could lose it there. We won't win it there. This struggle will endure as long as you and I live, I'm afraid. There's no indication that the Soviet Union ever changes its objectives. And this struggle is going to be won or lost in this third of the world, or approximately a third of the world, not now allied firmly either to the Soviet Union or to our Western allies. And this third of the world is almost entirely non-white. And we give the Soviet Union propaganda that's almost impossible for us to overcome. You know, they're pretty good inventors, and in many areas they've invented a lot of lies to tell about us and our allies. But all they have to do is to take the pictures out of our own newspapers of the rabid-looking white women in New Orleans spitting on the innocent looking little Negro children. Riots that occurred in Little Rock, the Poplarville incident. Every time there is a Negro home that has rocks thrown through the windows because somebody objects to their living there. These are taken out of our news magazines and our newspapers, circulated in this uncommitted third of the world. And so our friends say, when you travel there, and I travel there, well, how do you explain the fact that the United States claims to be the one area in the world where all people are given an equal opportunity? And if that is true, how do you explain Little Rock? How do you explain New Orleans? How do you explain Poplarville? And it's pretty hard to explain. So I say again, this is a very important problem. Now, you ask me the question, how do you break this circle? Well, you don't break it until a few more than half of the people want it broken. And you don't solve the problem with legislation in Washington or in the state capitol. Legislation helps a little. But this problem will not be solved until a few more than half of the people, white people and black people, want it solved. And we're willing to recognize that the problem in Detroit is one problem, in New York it's a different problem, in Washington it's a different problem, in whatever city you happen to live, it's a different kind of a problem. And the right solution for that community is the one that's worked out by the citizens of that community, white and black, the ablest, sitting down and first of all recognizing that this is an important problem that has to be solved, and then finding out what the facts are. You can't solve the problem until you know what the facts are. And that's the role the Civil Rights Commission is trying to fill in going around the country and holding these hearings, hoping that out of them, responsible people of all races will recognize that it's important that the facts be found and that people work at it. And I don't think it's important whether you break the circle with the school, with fair employment, with housing. Just let's break it somewhere.
I think you've indicated then that the answer to this problem is not going to come from the findings of your commission and its recommendations to the federal government.
Well, I wouldn't say that's entirely true. Of course, we made our first report on the September 9, 1959, more than a year ago. And I'm optimistic, maybe egotistical about it. But I think that our commission has made a very valuable contribution in that it has taken the civil rights discussion out of the area of conjecture. We've gone into the South with the voting hearings and demonstrated in Montgomery and in New Orleans and investigations elsewhere that it is a fact that able, competent Negroes are not permitted to vote. School teachers, lawyers, doctors, nurses, very responsible people, not permitted to vote because they're Negroes. And you can't argue about it. And the people in New Orleans can't argue about it. That is, they can't argue about the facts. The facts are there. Now, they can argue about whether it's desirable to let them vote, but the facts are they are not permitted to vote. And fair-minded people recognize that this is not justifiable. Well, out of these hearings that have been held in these areas around the country, a change in the climate has developed. So that in the last session of the Congress, they were talking about the problems and the solutions and the objections on the part of some people to a solution, because unfortunately there are still some people in this country that if they had their way, would handle this problem as the political leaders in South Africa would like to. There are some people, you know, that just feel that all Negroes are inferior because they were born black, although there is not a shred of evidence that that's the truth. And so you said, in asking me the question, that I didn't, it's probably true that our commission would not solve the problem. We won't solve it, but we'll have some recommendations again for the new president and the new Congress, and some of them will, if they are followed, will be useful. We're going to have a new report about the middle of January on discrimination in higher education, and we're very proud of it. It's going to be a fine, historical, accurate statement of the history of discrimination in higher education in this country. And then there's some recommendations that are a little surprising when you remember that three of our commissioners are out of the Old South. Now, some of the recommendations that I would like to have seen included are not there, and there's one important recommendation that is supported by the three men from the North and not by those in the South. But I think we're making a useful contribution. I hope we are.
One final question. You've indicated and commended the Negro population for their patience. Do they have any responsibility in finding the solution?
Yes, they do have a responsibility. Because after all, in the end, you have to remember what it is we're striving for. When I first went on the commission, many of my friends in the South labeled me and my colleagues first as communists. That's the popular thing. They discredit you by saying you're communists. The communists are trying to agitate the Negroes and cause commotion. Then next they allege that we're really mongrelizers. All we're trying to do is to come up with some recommendations that will make it possible for every black man to get a white wife and vice versa. Well, of course, this isn't true. And finally, you have to ask yourself, what is it that you're trying to accomplish? And so in a nutshell, I'll tell you what I think we're really striving for, what I think we ought to strive for. First, we ought to strive for a situation where every young American, black or white, is given an opportunity for all the education he can make use of. Not only through the grade school, but through the high school and through the university. And if he's got the ability to make a nuclear physicist, let's educate him so he can be a nuclear physicist or an accountant or something else. Then he must be given an opportunity for the kind of a job that will make use of that skill. And then once he has the job, he must be given the same opportunity to enjoy the privileges that come to a white citizen that makes the same social contribution. In the end, this is all we're striving for. And the problem of the Negro is to have him accepted as an individual. There are able, fine Negroes. There are those that are contemptible. My ancestors are Scotch-Irish. Some of them are able, some of them are contemptible. And if white people will look at Negroes as individuals, just like they look at white people, respect those that deserve respect, recognize them, help them, that's all we're trying to achieve.
Thank you very much. We've been discussing the Detroit, Michigan hearings of the United States Commission on Civil Rights with the chairman of that commission, Dr. John A. Hanna, the president of Michigan State University.
This program was a presentation of station WKAR at Michigan State University. Dr. Hanna was interviewed by WKAR News Director Rob Downey. This is the NAEB Radio Network.